Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Road to Recovery group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our final speaker, Wayne B.
I'm Wayne, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Wayne.
Grateful to be here, grateful to be sober. I love AA. Thanks for the invite, Wayne. I appreciate that. I enjoy following you and the missus on Facebook. I like some of your finds that you show on Facebook, and I like that you're a martial artist. I appreciate that as well. And I want to thank Lawrence for his 10-minute share and for, 13 years? Congratulations. And Jackie, I appreciate your share too. And you made a comment about how you got married to sobriety. I got divorced, so we're kind of, you know, a little bit. My sponsee, my wife ran off with my sponsee, so I'm not quite sure how that works in AA, but apparently he did want what I had when he told me, so he went with it, and good for him. That was 34 years, 38 years ago, and I still miss my sponsee. It's a heck of a deal. And I want to thank Mark for your share, and congratulations. I believe you probably celebrated 17 years, if I figured that out right. And I'm grateful for my sponsee, Hamish, and grand sponsee, Brian, because they're from Scotland, and I could understand everything you said. It was an amazing thing. I love AA. I love being a part of this thing. It's really a great deal. If there's anybody new, and you know, it's kind of nice sharing with a like-minded group of people, because I know where your group came from, Wayne, and I really respect structure, order, and discipline. And I don't know if I like accountability much, but I give into it because I need it. And it's an interesting thing. You know, a lot of the stories that I've heard, mine, I'm not different in that regard, but my story is I'm what you call a periodic alcoholic. When I first read in the big book, the description of the real alcoholic, that wasn't me as far as I could understand it. Cause I could stay without a drink for 3 weeks to a month, sometimes 2 months. But during that interim time, the madness of my mind would get me. And I didn't know that I was drinking for relief. I didn't know I was drinking for the effect. Had it not been for the doctor's opinion, I don't think I ever would have recovered. I think that I just for a quick snapshot, I'm 70 years old. I'm 42 years, 6 months, and 21 days sober, one day at a time. I have a sponsor. I sponsor others. I have a home group, and I'm in good stead in AA, and I'm not seeking anybody else's opinion about that. I just thought I'd share that. I'm an activist in Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe in AA. I believe in our traditions. I love this thing with all my heart, and I want to protect her. And that's just where I'm at with that. I go to meetings on a regular basis. I keep my commitments. If I can't, I call ahead of time and let them know. I'm a victim of structure and solution sharing. My sponsor always told me, he taught me early on, he says, bring your problems to me. If we can't solve them the AA way, we'll find someone who has experience. You solve that problem, and that's what you take to the meeting. Don't go dripping on the meeting. They've got their own problems. They're not interested in yours. And I wasn't sure if I liked that or not, but he didn't seem to care. I was a troubled kid. You know, I don't want to get into my childhood. My childhood isn't why I'm an alcoholic, but I just touch on it lightly so that you understand the dilemma of alcoholics of my type when they sometimes get to AA. My father was a truck driver, whiskey drinking alcoholic. He was a violent man. My dad drove truck out of Chicago. He worked for a guy named Jimmy Hoffa, and my dad brought his work home. My dad was a brute. He called himself a tough guy. I had an older brother and sister. My dad wanted me to be a tough guy like him. And you know, my brother was a tough guy like him. My sister was a tough guy like him. And I wrote poetry, and he had names for that. And that didn't make me an alcoholic, but it made life interesting in that alcoholic home I was raised in. I hear a lot of people sharing how they were raised in good homes, and some people had a great childhood, and that's not my story. That didn't make me alcoholic, but it had a lot to do with me getting here the way I got here. I've been in 17 psychiatric hospitalizations, several times in restraints, in straitjackets. I remember they would take me for a walk around the yard. It was a sloping hill around the East Moline State Insane Asylum. That's the exact name of it, East Moline State Insane Asylum. I wasn't being diagnosed alcoholic because a lot of the times what they call acting out, I didn't have a drink in my body. So they don't call that alcoholism because, you know, science still ain't figured it out. Maybe they will one day, as Bill said, but science ain't got it figured out yet. But I was going for a walk and I thought I'd escape. And so I ran away from my tender in a straitjacket and I tripped and rolled all the way down the hill, and they just let me there. They left me there for a while before they came and got me. I kind of liked it down there, if you got to know the truth. And I've been medicated from the age of 9 to the age of 27. I'm not giving an opinion about that. But the madness that was in my mind, the myth diagnoses I was placed on. And I don't fault the doctors for all their diagnoses. And here's why. They can't get inside to see a broken spirit and diagnose my behavior as being related to a broken spirit, which is, in my mind, the ism factor that links up with alcohol. I didn't know none of that stuff. How would I know any of that stuff? Science doesn't know that because they can't study the human spirit. Here we are. We're a study in human spirit here in this meeting. The kindred spirits. We are people who, once we put the drink down, the question is now what? Now what do we do? I didn't know that I came here initially with an alcohol problem. And then I realized that there's a solution linked to that alcohol problem. And it became a duality thing like Chuck C talked about. I was just really confused. I didn't understand what was wrong with me. You know, I raised in that crazy home. You know, Bill Wilson writes that any child raised in an alcoholic home was more bound to be more or less neurotic. And my neuroses didn't appear when I drank. See, I'm the guy that drinking solved it for me. When I take a drink, you know, I don't even notice, you know, what makes me an alcoholic is on page 44 succinctly. When I honestly want to, I can't quit drinking entirely. And when drinking, I can't control the amount I take. That makes me alcoholic. That's how simple it is. But it was too simple for me. I needed some further evidence by you guys sharing your stories for me. And so I got raised in that crazy home. I got diagnosed mentally retarded at the age of in the eighth grade. I got put in a retarded class. They called it retarded. They didn't call it special ed. And I spent the rest of my high school years in a retarded class. They changed that the year after I got out of school and called it special ed. That didn't make me alcoholic, but it sure got me ready for my first drink. And I'll tell you something. I can tell you this. I love Budweiser more than life itself because Budweiser done something for me it's not biochemically indicated to do. Alcohol is biochemically indicated to do one thing and one thing only, and that's to sedate me. And Dr. Silkworth put it really well when he started going through the characteristics of the abnormal drinker. You see, when I drink alcohol, it may be sedating my body, but it's elevating my mind. And I know scientifically it's not supposed to do that. All I know is when I took my first drink at 17 years of age, I wasn't retarded no more. I got good looking. I saw a girl at the senior dance. Never talked to a girl the whole time in school. In the retarded class, we didn't mix with regular population. And I saw her, and I didn't, and I never even talked to a girl except in that class. And I walked right up to her and asked her to dance, found out later that night sex meant two people. I didn't know that either. They didn't teach us about sex ed in the retarded class, so I didn't know what I was getting into. She ruined my sex life. I've been having sex since I was 13. I didn't know anybody else was involved. Complicated the entire procedure. She ends up pregnant. She's 16, I'm 17. I'm risking going to jail for statutory rape at 17 years of age. They didn't care I was in the retarded class. All of a sudden, legally, I'm not retarded anymore. That's an amazing thing. So my dad, we got married, and I went and joined the military. The military actually took me. The Navy took me. And by Thanksgiving 1969, I'm in Vietnam, and I have no clue what's going on. Vietnam did not make me an alcoholic, but it put a definite spin on what was already spun. And I needed a drink. Fast forward. 1972, I'm sleeping in a dumpster behind Larry's Oasis. My father 12 steps me. I didn't know that's what he was doing. My father had gone off and joined this cult called AA. I know we're categorized as a subcult. I understand all that. I think it's cute. I don't mind being categorized as a subcult with the benefits and results we're getting. I'll tell you that right now. And I didn't know what was happening to me. All I know is I would go weeks without a drink. I didn't know I was in terror of what was going to happen if I did drink, so I would go as long as I possibly could, and then I would take that first drink, and because I've got enough science back behind me, I understand alcohol in and of itself is not an addictive substance. Alcohol by nature is not addictive. 9 out of 10 people can drink it safely, so it baffled me how I could go weeks without a drink and then insanely pick up a drink, and I would drink until something stopped me, and then I could go weeks again. And some of you understand the madness was in my mind. I didn't understand that. 1972, my dad pays to visit me. I'm sleeping in a dumpster behind Larry's Oasis. I have no idea I'm on my way to AA. He visits me in my dumpster. And by the way, I was home. It was like a little after midnight on Halloween. And I was alone. Some of you women are picky just because I'm living in a dumpster. You don't like where I live, my crib. You know what I mean? I even tried to get Dirty Sally. You know, by the way, I had a resentment against some of you women that would share, because I know you've heard it over there in Plymouth, England as well. These women will share. And I'll talk about how they was a fallen woman, right? Well, none of you fell into my dumpster. I want you to know that. So uppity where I'm at. And I didn't understand all that. This is so lonely. And when my dad visited me, the last time I saw my father was at the Rock Island County Courthouse. My father had taken me to court to get a restraining order against me, and I'm not going to tell you why here. I already told my sponsor, my fifth step, but it's not appropriate for this forum. But my father took me and got a restraining order, and that restraining order read in part as such: Wayne Everett Butler will not go within 1,000 yards of his mother. He will not go within 1,000 yards of his wife or ex-wife. He will not go within 1,000 yards of any of his children. And I remember hearing that like somebody punched me right in the gut. And on the way out of there, I'm thinking, wait a minute, you can't tell me I can't go see my kids. And the thought was just, now I'm going to go see my kids tonight. And my dad comes around from the courthouse, and he walks up on me in broad daylight, and he pulls that pistol out of the back of his pants like he often did, put it to my head and pulled that hammer back. And he says, you and I both know that restraining order isn't worth the paper it's written on. Know this, if you violate that order, I help bring you into the world. I'll be the one that takes you out. And he meant it. And that was the last time I saw him. And now he's standing in my dumpster. And here's what he says to me. He says, Wayne, do you want to come home with me tonight? I had no idea he was trying to 12-step me. I had recall of that day at the courthouse, and I'm figuring he's going to put me down. And then I looked around my little room, and I said, no, thanks, Dad. I'm doing fine. Make a long story short, he left. I found out later that the old-timers told him, if he argues with you, leave. Don't screw up our chance with your kid. And that's pretty good information, by the way. Make just as fast forward, I left that night. I jumped out of that dumpster that night and made that walk, the walks that we've all made. And this was my entry to AA, though I didn't know it. I didn't know it was coming. I don't think any of us know it's coming, do we, at the time? I walk past this old truck driver coffee shop, dime a cup of coffee on the east end of Moline. I look inside, and there's usually a bunch of people in there, a couple semi-trucks in the parking lot. There isn't a living soul in there except this one 800-year-old woman slowly wiping down. Yeah, I know, I exaggerated. Slowly wiping down the coffee bar. I sized her up, and I knew I could work her. I knew I could work her because I'm a bum. I'm a bum. Now they call us homeless. They've upgraded us. I was a bum. That's what they called me. And I go in that restaurant, and I sit down on the cafe, that wobbly cafe stool, and I sit close to the cash register for some odd reason, and she looks up and she crooks her head at me, drops that rag on the counter, and shoots me a smile. Ain't nobody smiling at me. She comes walking down to me. She brings me a glass of water and a hot cup of coffee, and she says, what can I do for you, sweetie? She kind of threw me off my game because I wasn't ready for that. I had my shtick all ready for her, but I recovered because I'm hungry. And I went into my routine, and I told her things that I wasn't wanting to tell my sponsor in my fifth step for fear he'd judge me, but I was willing to tell her to get a cigarette or a sandwich. And I told her about that insane home I lived in. I told her about when I was 9 years old, this neighborhood guy, we know what his name is now, his name is Pedophile. What he did was he took me hostage in the coal bin of his basement and he tortured me. That didn't make me alcoholic, but it became interesting when I tried to find my way in and out of AA. I told her about that. I told her about being diagnosed retarded. I told her about going to Vietnam. I told her some stories that made tears roll down her face. I even started crying because I needed her to believe me. And I'm thinking she's crying because of my story, but I found out later she wasn't crying because of my story. She'd heard it 1,000 times before. She was in a program called Al-Anon. Now, by the way, if any of you here are an Al-Anon and you're a waiter or a waitress, please put a pin on and give us alcoholics a fighting chance. I didn't see her coming. She kept me there, took me hostage, what she did, because her husband, Harvey, who owns that restaurant, he's sober a while, and he's having a hard time staying sober. And she learned in Al-Anon that an alcoholic's basic hope, sometimes only hope, in the throes of alcoholism, is to find another alcoholic to work with. And she decided it was going to be me. And who knew? Who knew? So she keeps me there. I'm there a couple of days, and in comes Harvey. Harvey's this little 5'6" guy. I'm 6'3". I'm looking down at him, and he's got this nose. I mean, he's so ugly, it made me feel good about myself. Isn't that something, how alcoholics like me, and I presume some of you, can reach up just far enough out of the gutter to look down on somebody that's successful and judge them? That's what I did. And then he gave me the bum's handshake. Now, I like cash. You know the bum's handshake? Cash. I like cash. But he put a coin in my hand, and I got to tell you the truth. I could tell by the feeling of that coin I couldn't spend whatever it was. Because I know what coins feel like. I'm a bum. So when he got done shaking my hand, I now know he's trying to shake alcoholism out of me, but it didn't take. And so I opened up my hand, and I see this brass coin. It's got 2 A's on it. I have no clue. It didn't say Alcoholics Anonymous. It just had 2 A's back in those days. I know it's different now with all these coins you got. And I looked then, I had no idea what it meant, and I wasn't about to ask what it meant. And then he glibly says, turn it over. You know how these old guys are, turn it over. So I flipped it over, and it didn't say nothing about money, food, shelter, or Pell-Mell tailor-made cigarettes. It had a prayer, God grant me something. I didn't give a rip about that prayer. And then Harvey says, you take this coin down tomorrow to 410 16th Street, Moline. There's some friends of mine there. You get there about noontime, show them that coin and tell them I sent you, and they'll help you. And I'll be along later in the day to see how you're doing. He says, when you get there, you'll see a light bulb hanging on a cord. If that light's on, that means they're in there waiting for you. Go on in. I don't think you should tell newcomers that kind of information. I went the next day because I wanted something to eat. Harvey didn't say I'm an alcoholic. I guess he had a detector of some sort that he thought I might do well there. So I went there the next day, and Harvey said, if that light's on, go in. So I found the address. It was in the basement of a condemned building, and the light bulb was behind this cellar window. And he said, if it's on, go in. It wasn't on. It was flickering. And I didn't know what that meant. Now, some people have denial in that Al-Anon program, but in AA, it's called self-delusion. And I'll tell you what, I didn't know why that light was flickering. It didn't occur to me it might be a short. It didn't occur to me the bulb might be loose. It didn't occur to me the plug might be loose. I decided it was code, that it was talking to me. Yep, I'm one of those guys. And it wouldn't quit flickering. And I'm out there going like this, trying to get it to stop, and it won't stop. And I lost my mind. I left, and I went to mooch me some Budweiser's at Larry's Oasis. And I got oiled up, and about 8 o'clock that night, which is a very interesting thing, 8 o'clock that night, I went back to get what I got coming, because I've been thinking about those guys all day. I've been thinking about that light bulb that won't stop blinking, and I'm drinking, and it's blinking, and I'm drinking, and it's blinking. And I thought, the heck with it. I went back there. I got there about 8 o'clock that night. Didn't even look for the light bulb. I don't care if it's on or gone. I'm going in. And I went charging through that basement doorway, failing to notice that door header is 5'10"-ish. I'm 6'3"-ish. And I ran smack dab into the header of that door at the eyebrow. The impact lifted me off of my feet, and I slid into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And inside that room was a round table. I found out it was round so the devil couldn't corner you. Oh, yeah, that was that group. I slid between two of these guys, and this old crusty buzzard gets out of his chair, stands over me, and I don't know if you watch baseball or not, but he gave me the safe sign, stood right over me and gave me the safe sign, and then he ground. He said, slide right in here, you big dummy. We got a wrench to fit every nut that comes in the door, and by the looks of you, it's going to have to be an adjustable wrench. I didn't like him right away. If you ever had the wind knocked out of you, I did. I'm just trying to breathe, and he's talking to me, and he's lifting me up off the deck. I finally get my breath back, and then he says, my name's Barney. Like, I don't really care who you are. And then he says, and I'm an alcoholic. And I thought, you poor SOB. That's what I thought. And I've been in just enough therapy to know when the guy sitting across that desk from me self-discloses something to me, I know what they want. They're trying to seduce me into giving them something back. So when he said I'm an alcoholic, I thought about it for a second. I said, well, I'm ADD. And he says, I'll bet you are. And I said, you know what else I think I am? He says, what? He says, I'm OCD. He says, I'll bet you are. And then he jumped in. He says, you know what else I think you might be? I said, what's that? He says, I think you might be ODD. And I never heard of the diagnosis of ODD. So I said, what's that? He says, you are very odd. And then he says, I'm going to be your sponsor. That's how I got started in AA. That was my welcome to AA. Fast forward 5 years and 5 days, and I get to take what I think is my last drink. On November 8, 1977, I showed up early to help my sponsor set up for the noon meeting. I was drinking beer out on the front porch of the group. I had 3 cans of beer, drank 3 more to drink. My sponsor showed up and said, come on in and help me set up for the meeting. Didn't say a thing about the fact I drank those 3 beers. Come in and help me set up for the meeting. I don't know why. I can't explain it to you. Is it odd or is it God? Who's to say? But after that meeting, I forgot to go back out and get that beer. And from that day to this, from that moment to this, I've not had another drink of alcohol in any form at all. In any amount at all. And my life began. And I just want to say that if you're an alcoholic of my type, with all the psychiatric misdiagnoses that I was presented with, I don't blame them. I want to repeat that. I don't blame them. But they wanted to put me back on medication again when I was sober in my first 7 years because I was acting out sober. Like none of us ever did that, right? But you know what? I got my first accurate diagnosis. And it was a self-diagnosis in Alcoholics Anonymous from Bill Wilson himself from the grave. His experience written in the big book in the 12 and 12 and the stories in AA Comes of Age began to develop a story that I could believe in, that I could believe that my isms, that my social, emotional thought processes, all those problems are linked to a thing called alcoholism. And that was the first time that I woke to that knowledge. And at 7 years sober, I should say undrunk, at 7 years, the night before I went to this meeting, I put a gun up to a sponsee's head. And I told him if he didn't work the steps, I'd kill him. And the next day I went to the meeting. And by the way, he didn't drink. I just want to add that. And then the next day I went to a meeting and got all spiritual. I mean, after putting a gun to my sponsee's head the night before, I'm now at this meeting spiritually pontificating because there's effect produced in talking about God. Even if you ain't got one, there's an effect produced by talking about one. And just to make a long story short, you know, after that night, obviously I didn't kill myself. Some people in AA played doctor. They played doctor. They told me to get back on medication. And I almost did because I was easily influenced at that critical part of my time. But you know what I did? I called my sponsor instead after I went and saw a psychiatrist. He wanted to put me on 3 medications again. And I called my sponsor. And I said, there's got to be another way. I don't want to do that. And just to make that long story short, I think I got about 4 minutes left. 8 at Wayne. So I found some history about Bill Wilson. And you know, my sponsor got me a one-way bus ticket to Los Angeles. At 7 years sober, I went up and was in the Pacific group. I learned that there's a whole host of alcoholics of my personality type in Clancy's backyard. That's what I discovered. You see, where I was at, I would say it like this. They were a bunch of Dr. Bob types, cool and calm all the time. And then there's the Bill W. type, you know, the fart in the windstorm. You don't know where he's at, but you know he's been in the area. And that was like me and my emotions. And I got a really good understudy during that 6 months I was there. And then I went back to Illinois because I had unfinished business. And what I did was I saddled up the AA way. And I haven't allowed other outside influences to change my mind. I redoubled my efforts in Alcoholics Anonymous. I retook the 12 steps. And I got really involved in steps 10, 11, and 12. And my life was changing right in front of my eyes. And after spending that 6 months out in California and then coming back and retaking the steps, you know, at 10 years sober, I became a police officer. That's impossible to do if you've been psychiatrically institutionalized 17 times, you've been arrested 9 times, and 7 of those times I wasn't drinking when I got arrested. It's hard to become a cop unless you live in Iowa. They're the considered good experience. I became a cop, and my life has taken on dimensions that I didn't know was even possible. I didn't have any dreams when I got here, folks. I didn't have dreams. I had nightmares, and I had nightmares running left and right. And what happened was you gave me a dream. You gave me hope. You gave me possibilities. You said that if I would follow the guidelines, you know, I learned that, I beg your pardon, I have 7 minutes left. I just now noticed I said it early. I discovered that there's a certain ethos to sponsorship, and it was alluded to by all 3 speakers tonight, and I appreciate that. I didn't understand the idea of sponsorship. I thought it was command and control. Put a gun to their head and they'll do what you want them to do. I was out of my mind. And what happened was I discovered this ethos. And I understand today what my job as a sponsor or a mentor is. It's my sole purpose. And I like the way Bill referenced soul, S-O-U-L. My sole purpose is to guide, direct, advise, and encourage another member to grow along spiritual lines the AA way. And there's something very spiritual about having structure. There's something very spiritual about being orderly. There is something very, very spiritual about discipline and accountability. I just don't like it. There's a part of me that doesn't like that. And yet, because I know that the day could come, I could take a drink again someday. I could. And you know, but here it is, 42 years later, one day at a time, my life is sweet. You know, I like following Wayne because he's a martial artist. You know, in February of 2017, I was training to join the Senior Olympics as a kickboxer. I wanted that so bad. I trained for it. I worked for it. I was invited to try out for the Senior Olympics as a kickboxer. And on April 17th, the day of my sponsor's death, April 17th, 2002, he passed away. And on April 17th of 2017, I had gone to a seminary to pay respects to my sponsor. And as I do every April 17th from his death to now. And I left there. I jumped on my Harley Davidson, went for a ride, and I'm going downtown to pick up some materials for a step workshop that I was involved in. And I'm just not a care in the world, folks. And some of you here, you understand what I mean. I don't have a care in the world. My life is good. Let me set this so I don't lose track. My life is good. And all of a sudden, I see this SUV coming the other way. We're going like this. And I look at her, and we make eye contact. And then she whipped that wheel right into me and took me out sideways. She ran over on me on purpose and dang near killed me. And I did. It was a terrible accident. I'm not looking for pity. This would be the last group to do that in anyway. But I was busted up. I was tore everything. Every bone on the left side of my body was broken. And it broke my heart because I've been riding motorcycles for 50 years. And not only that, but the damage that was done to my ribs, the way they healed is I can't risk being kicked in the chest because one of those breaks could go through my heart because one rib pierced the veil of my heart. And you know what? Here, what we do in AA is when something is taken away by the universe, we find something to replace it with, something just as valuable, something just as useful. And instead of sitting around feeling sorry for myself, I sold my motorcycle. You know, the guys I ride with, they scooped my motorcycle up off the street. I didn't know what happened to it for sure. When I come out of my coma, I didn't know where my motorcycle was, neither did the police. But my group had gone down there and scooped it up. And while I was in the hospital, they repaired my Harley completely for me and gave it back to me when I got released. And so I had my beautiful Harley, and I was going to keep riding, if you want to know the madness about that. And then I had a brain injury in that motorcycle accident, and that brain injury brought on this thing called vertigo, unpredictably. And I can't ride anymore. And I also can't compete anymore. And so here's the thing. And I'm not blowing smoke up nobody's butt. I get joy out of watching Wayne. I saw him on Facebook today or yesterday, and he had his black belt on. And instead of feeling envy and feeling self-pity, I was grateful for his efforts. And I've seen him competing over the past year, how he went back as an old man and got in and showed those young bucks just what to do. And that's what we do in AA, too. That's what we do. That's what we elders do in AA. That's what I was taught by my sponsor and his sponsor. I was taught to take responsibility for my role in AA, to take responsibility for my behavior, to be a good example of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't like that either. Sometimes I like to be a bad example. And I just want to go out and do something stupid just because I can. And then I have to remember that there might be some newcomer watching me that my behavior is going to influence them in a bad way, like somebody else has influenced mine early on. All those things were critically important. So now I found a replacement for riding a motorcycle. I got me a bicycle. I can ride a bicycle, but I can't ride a motorcycle. So I'm out there on my big bad bicycle with people that know I used to ride a Harley. And yeah, they make fun of me. Yes, they do. They mock me. They ridicule. Where's that helmet you got there, big boy? They just love. That's the people I run with a little bit. All of that. As I look back, as I look over the time that I've been sober, I haven't been back to a psychiatric hospital except to be a message carrier. I haven't been in jail except to be a message carrier. You know, when I became a police officer, I arrested an awful lot of drunk drivers, and I got to take a lot of them to AA. I had a judge in my pocket, and if I arrested you, I could go to court if you'd agree to go to AA, and that judge let me take you to AA. And in that 5 years I did that, we had 37 sober alcoholics when I left the police department. And they all went through the court system, and they all got, I'm not taking credit, by the way. God and AA get the credit. And I just want to kind of close with this. I understand the madness of my mind is still there, ladies and gentlemen. It's called alcoholism. It is never going to go away. I don't think it's stalking me. I don't think it's out in the parking lot waiting to get me after a meeting. I don't buy into that. But what I do know is it's never going to go away. And all I got to do is take a day off here, a day off there, blow off a commitment. Blow off that commitment, start showing up late, start that 1 degree drift into madness. Because I know this for a fact. I have 4 members of my family that all had sobriety in AA at one time, including my father. And all 4 of them died drunk, 2 by suicide. They died drunk after AA. And I close with this. I was warned about that and how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path. Ladies and gentlemen, path is not plural. And I got into a lot of trouble, as many do, trying to pluralize this path. And the second line, those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. I'm here to report to you that I can verify that those 4 members of my family did not give themselves up completely, and those who did took it back. And you know what? It isn't that I'm afraid of what's going to happen. It's just that the joy of AA, I'm happy, joyous, and free just for today. just for today. I've had a reprieve, and I know that for a fact. Tomorrow could be different. So it's been my great pleasure to be with you folks tonight. I really appreciate the invitation, Wayne. Godspeed. Thank you.
Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you so much.
Wayne. Yeah. Wayne.